We are at the Granley Bakken Resort, just outside Tahoe City, at one of the Keystone Symposium meetings. This one's New Insights into Health Span and Diseases of Aging, from Molecular to Functional Senescence, and with Lenny Guarenti, who we saw a few months ago back at your building on Ames Street.
MIT.
At MIT, the Novartis Professor in the Department of Biology at MIT, Paul F. Glenn Lab for the Sciences of Aging. And you gave an opening talk at this meeting as well. Do you want to sort of bring us up to date on since we saw you last and what's been happening in your lab since then?
Yeah, well, there's a lot going on. And, you know, in talks like this, you really only get to talk about a small subset of everything that's going on in your lab. But what I focused on in my talk here were sort of two general areas. The first one is, I think, very related to diseases and aging. And it deals with the notion that sirtuins are molecules that regulate the maintenance of somatic tissues, tissues like muscle, like brain, and that these sirtuins are upregulated by food scarcity. And so that under times of food scarcity, there's a premium on maintaining these tissues and keeping them alive as long as possible. And the evolutionary reason for that could be that when there's not food around, it's not a good time to reproduce, but the better strategy would be to reproduce later. So what you want to do is delay reproduction, which is great if you can do it, but of course then you have to be around later, A. B, you have to be young enough to reproduce later. So it would make sense then that you really want to max out the maintenance of somatic tissues during these times of food scarcity, otherwise known as calorie restriction. And so the aspect that we really focus on in my lab is how sirtuins protect tissues like the brain, muscle, heart, and so on in times of food scarcity. And what we do is we do some experiments by actually limiting food to trigger activity, but the other way we do it is by manipulating genes. We can increase or decrease the activity of any one of the seven sirtuins, and we focus mainly on SIRT1, mm-hmm. which is the top dog sirtuin, and we can manipulate the gene in a mouse.
There are seven sirtuins.
There are seven mammalian sirtuins. Yeah, but if you look at the literature, there are maybe now in excess of 1,500 papers that have appeared in the last decade on sirtuins, and probably 3/4 of them are about SIRT1. So that's really, it seems to be the most important one, and that's where I would place my bet. But the others are not to sneeze at. There's just a little bit less activity at this point. So we either raise or lower the activity of SIRT1 in a given tissue, let us say the brain. We do that genetically, and then we say, well, what's going to be the effect on aging? Okay. So what we could do is we could simply make mice get old, like 2 to 3 years old, and then look carefully at pathophysiological changes of aging and ask whether they're protected by increased activity of SIRT1. Okay, so that would be one approach. The approach we favor is not that one, but to impose on that mouse a disease model. So to make that mouse prone to get a disease that looks like a human disease. So for example, the major diseases of the brain that occur with aging are neurodegenerative diseases. Right. And so we've been really focused in my lab on Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's disease, and Huntington's disease. Mm-hmm. And what these diseases all have in common is they involve neurodegeneration. Of course, they're devastating diseases. And they're late onset. So aging is really a risk factor. It's feeding in to the disease state. Okay, so if SIRT1, and perhaps other sirtuins, but right now we're focused on SIRT1, really is able to maintain youthfulness in a tissue, then if we raise the levels of SIRT1, let's say in the brain, genetically, we can ask, does it protect in these disease models? Conversely, if we lower the levels of SIRT1 or actually remove it entirely from the brain, does it exacerbate the disease model? Now, what do I mean by the disease model? Typically, what's done is one extracts our best information about the human disease. So let me use Alzheimer's as an example. So Alzheimer's is very, very closely associated with this toxic myeloid peptide of 42 amino acids called A-beta. And the production of A-beta in the brain is quite well understood. It's produced from a larger protein, and there are several proteases that cleave that larger protein to eventually give rise to the A-beta peptide, okay? Now, it turns out that there are families that are prone to getting Alzheimer's early in life, and they affect this pathway that produces A-beta. So one family has a mutation in the protein precursor itself, making it more susceptible to this cleavage, so you simply make it more rapidly. The other has mutations in one of the protease enzymes that does the cleavage, that makes it more active. So again, you make more of this peptide. So that's useful knowledge for two reasons. First of all, it really implicates this pathway in the human disease firmly. So you're not just guessing that, well, maybe A-beta production has something to do with Alzheimer's. There's really good evidence that it has something to do with Alzheimer's. Secondly, it gives you the means to construct the mouse model for Alzheimer's. And in this particular case, what we did is we took the human gene that is in the protein that produces A-beta itself and carries the mutation that predisposes. That's in the mouse now. And also is the mutation in the protease gene. That's in the mouse. They're both in there. So now the mouse, you've raised the levels of production of this peptide in the mouse, and you can ask what happens. Okay, okay. So the reason we would like the disease model as opposed to just letting mice get old and seeing what happens as a function of the levels of sirtuins, first of all, the disease plays out more rapidly. So my postdocs, you know, their time is valuable, and they can do an experiment in 3 to 6 months as opposed to 2 to 3 years. And that's critical difference, right? Practical difference. Second difference is you're very close to a human disease when you do it this way. So you're closer, I think, to translating the basic science into an avenue of therapy for the human disease, because you're actually studying that disease. So that's what we've been doing. And in the example I'm talking about, we have mice now that have been engineered to get diseases like either Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's disease, or Huntington's disease. And then we either raise SIRT1 in the brain or get rid of it in the brain and ask what happens to these diseases. So that's the system, that's the gestalt. And we can do that with Alzheimer's and brain diseases. We can do it with muscular degenerative diseases, right. Muscular dystrophy. We can do it for metabolic diseases, diabetes, another pretty big disease, and so on and so forth, osteoporosis, cardiovascular disease, and so on. There are ways to engineer these disease models in the mouse. And then what we want to know is if we start to manipulate the sirtuins to change their activity, and we do it genetically now, we're not doing much with drugs at this point, because that's yet another complication, that the drug has to work, it has to get to the target tissue, and so on and so forth. But if we manipulate the gene, we're pretty confident we can change the level of activity of these sirtuins and then see what happens.
Okay, so one of the questions that always comes up is the model, is this a reasonable basis for extrapolation? Mm-hmm. I mean, I was talking to Mark Tater and Paul Shaw and Sean Oldham earlier about CR, caloric restriction, and asking them whether that, in fact, is a good strategy for humans and to extend your lifespan. There seems to be a lot written about that, and they sort of looked at me and said, well, yes, if you're a rodent or mm-hmm. yeast or a mouse or something.
Yeah.
But when they were by no means convinced that this was a model that you could then extend into humans, and one of the arguments was, well, you know, if we were designed, in quotes, by natural selection to be eating fewer calories, then that's what we'd be doing. So, mm-hmm.
Well, let me address that
question. There's two questions there, I know.
Let me address it in the most general sense. Is how do we know that anything we do in the laboratory has relevance for humans?
Right.
This really applies to all basic research, period. If you're studying anything other than a human being,
right,
how do you know that what you're studying is human relevant? And, you know, all I can say is it's a great question. You don't know. The truthful answer is you don't know. On the other hand, it's the best you can do. If you're really, a scientist who likes to ask precise questions and get at mechanisms at a molecular level, okay, then I don't see how you can get any closer to a human than using the mouse system. So, you know, my answer is yes, it would be wonderful if there were some way we could non-invasively do these kinds of experiments in people, okay? But you can't do it. So this is what we're stuck with. Now, that said, you can say, well, what's the track record been? And, you could take cancer. It's a good example. People have been studying cancer in rodents for 50 years. They've been studying it at a molecular level for 35 years, mm-hmm. Okay? So how much of what they've learned in rodents is directly human relevant? And the answer, of course, is not all of it, okay? But so the skeptic could say, well, you're spending all this money doing all this work on mice. And of course, I think the situation gets worse and worse and worse as you get down to lower and lower and lower organisms, like fruit flies, and then C. elegans, and then yeast. So, but even mouse has the same question. And you say, well, let's look at new cancer drugs. Are there any new cancer drugs that we know of that are actually helping people now? Okay. So one of those drugs is Gleevec, that's used to treat certain kinds of leukemias, okay? Where did that come from, that drug? Well, it came from studies in mice where there was an oncogene that was identified in mice and in murine viruses called ABL and kinase, and that was the target to which the drug Gleevec was developed. So that's a pretty ringing success.
Right.
Okay? Breast cancer, there's a drug, Herceptin, okay, that's effective against one category of breast cancers, and that's the category in which expression of the EGF receptor, okay, has gone up. So these epithelial cells have high levels of this receptor, so they're really poised for growth, okay? And
that's EGF being
and that's part of the problem with the tumor. And this receptor was identified as an oncogene 25 years ago. And even then it was shown that you could actually blunt the growth potential of tumors by blocking that receptor, in that case with an antibody that would bind to it in the outside. And that's basically the therapy. So, you know, there clearly are examples where, straight direct lines can be drawn between basic research in rodents and drugs that are benefiting people now. That said, of course, there are a lot of work gets done that is not immediately translatable. And there's just no way of knowing at the outset how easy it's going to be to get from the basic research problem you're studying to the clinic and then to a drug that really works. But as I said, I think it's the best system we have now. I can't think of a better way to do it. I can't think of any other way to do it. And you're not going to know if it's human relevant until you get that drug in the clinic, in humans, with a particular disease, and ask, is it beneficial?
Go back to the point you started with, which is this notion of the conflicting requirements of maintaining a healthy soma, body, tissue, in conditions of excess, that works fine. In conditions of restriction or in conditions of famine or of need, there's the conflict of reproductive success.
Mm-hmm. This is, I think, right now a huge, huge area of contention in the field, in that a lot of the theoretical evolutionary biologists, Tom Kirkwood, proposed that there's sort of a trade-off between resources going towards reproductive success on the one hand, or towards tissue maintenance on the other hand. And if you take away from one, or if you give to one, it's at the expense of the other. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, would still, to give an honest answer, say this idea of trade-offs, we still don't know how accurate it is. Because there's certainly examples where you can get mutant organisms, okay, be it worms or even flies, that live longer because you've mutated a particular gene, okay, and still have a normal brood size. So they're still able to reproduce. So the two can be uncoupled in the laboratory, okay? So that's good, but I don't think it necessarily says that the two are uncoupled in a normal, unmutated organism. They could still be coupled. And one reason for having a little bit of doubt that they are really totally uncoupled is if you take, for example, one of these worms that lives a long time and has a roughly normal brood size, okay? So it's a mutant. And you put it in competition with a wild type, a normal worm, okay, in the laboratory, under conditions where you keep changing the diet regimen from good to bad, good to bad, good to bad, and ask who wins, who's more fit to compete under those conditions, okay? It's the wild type, and the mutant loses. Okay, so that, at least to my mind, leaves open the possibility that the two things are coupled. And when you uncouple them by mutation, it comes at a cost to the animal.
So you would know that in the last issue of the year of Nature, there was a paper in there from Linda Partridge's lab, Grandison, Piper, and Partridge. And the commentary basically was saying that dietary restriction, which we've been talking about, promotes longevity, but impairs fecundity. So here we have this antagonistic pleiotropy, mm-hmm. if you like, which I think George Williams, in fact, wrote about mm-hmm. it back in 57. When the amino acids in the diet are fine-tuned, however, lifespan can be increased without loss of fecundity, at least in fruit flies. So this is the point you're making, that possibly there's some tweaking there, some engineering that can be done, right?
I'm not sure how to interpret that result.
Okay.
Okay, so I would go back and say, well, what does that mean? That you can tweak the composition of the food, okay, and find a composition that will extend the lifespan and not impair fecundity. What does that mean? Now, calorie restriction, I would be very loath, by the way, to use the term calorie restriction to describe this regimen in flies. So calorie restriction, to my mind, is defined by a method that's been carried out in rodents for some 75 years now, which involves taking the food and just giving the animal less of it, okay? Right. Not fiddling around with the composition of the food, just giving it less, okay? And the implication under those conditions is that you're imposing an energy limitation on the animal. So let's say you give the animal 70% of the amount of food that it would normally eat if you let it feed ad libitum, okay? Mm-hmm. What the mouse does is it goes through an adjustment period, a transition period, where it's adjusting to that lower amount of food, okay? And it downsizes itself, at least almost most tissues, and the body weight of the animal downsizes roughly in proportion with the reduction of food. So after that happens, you've got an animal eating 70% as much food, but it only weighs 70% as much,
right,
okay?
Right.
So, you know, simplistically, you would say there should be no difference in that animal, but there's a huge difference in the physiology of that animal. So it's there's a qualitatively different state that you've induced in that animal, which takes time to set up. It doesn't happen immediately. It's not like fasting. Mm-hmm. And that everything we associate with calorie restriction is a product of that adjustment. Right. Okay. Now, to extrapolate from that to a fruit fly and say, now we're going to, and the fruit fly also has carbohydrates in the diet, energy source, and amino acids, and so on and so forth, but we're going to play with a few things. And it's interesting that you can make the fly live longer, right? I don't gainsay that. But to my mind, there's no way of knowing if that has anything to do with calorie restriction as it's been practiced in rodents over the decades. Okay, so that's point number one.
Okay.
Okay? The second point is, again, with this diet, it's like a little bit like the argument I was making with the mutant in the worm. So you've got a sort of a contrived situation, which is important because that's how we study things in biology, is we vary the genetic makeup of an organism or something about the environment of the organism. And you have to do that. It's very important to do that. But I think you also have to always be cognizant of the fact that when you've done that, and you want to then make some broad evolutionary conclusion about it, I think it's tricky. So again, I would ask that fly that's given that diet, okay, what if you put it in some sort of competitive situation where the fly that eats the normal diet doesn't live as long but is equally fertile? You know, is there some cost that these experiments haven't revealed,
mm-hmm.
but that nonetheless have occurred?
Right.
So I think, to my mind, it's an open question, this issue of trade-offs. I think it's logical, and the Kirkwood theory, the somatic disposable soma theory, is extremely appealing intellectually, okay? Whether the trade-offs are obligatory or not, I think is the question. And I would say at this point in time, we don't know.
Does make the point rather nicely though, doesn't it, that whether there's agreement or not here, whether there's controversy or not, this is an exciting and busy time in this field that is really relatively recent. I mean, as I've said to the other guys, when you think that Francis Bacon was writing about this in some detail in the early 1600s.
Yeah, no, I think there's been a big uptick in the last decade.
Yeah,
in the field. And one thing I do is I try to keep up with the Sirtuin literature.
Right.
And so I check PubMed, and I used to check PubMed, maybe once a month, then once a week. Now every day, and every day there are new papers.
Right.
If you don't check, then you're behind. You're falling behind.
Yeah.
And I think that's a reflection of how the field has really exploded.
The trouble with that, of course, is keeping up with anything is just enormously difficult. The data
is out there.
That's true,
especially if you're interested in more than just aging.
Yeah, how do you keep up with all this data? I
must say, our work, within the field of aging, really has implications that extend beyond aging. In metabolism, for example, I think that protein acetylation and deacetylation is critically important in regulating metabolic pathways in cells. So, the fact that proteins are acetylated has been known for quite a long time, okay? And then really up until 10 years ago or so, all we knew is that, histones were acetylated, and the histones are the proteins, of course, that coat the DNA in the chromatin. And their acetylation correlated with gene activity, mm-hmm. okay? But now it turns out that many proteins, maybe almost all the proteins in a cell, are acetylated. And the question is that just a decoration, window dressing, or is it functional? And what the sirtuins are doing, I think, the fact that these are regulated deacetylases, that by regulating all these proteins, these non-histone proteins, these transcription factors, transcription cofactors, that they're having these major effects on cell physiology underscores the important notion that protein acetylation is highly regulatory and it's highly linked to metabolism. You ask the question, just to complete this thought on metabolism, then we can get back to aging. When we metabolize either carbohydrates, glucose, or fat, okay, what is the product of metabolism that drives energy in cells? Okay? Answer, acetyl-CoA, both cases. Okay? Then you ask, what is the, when a protein gets acetylated on a lysine, what is the substrate for acetylation? What donates the acetyl group? Acetyl-CoA. So I think there's no way that protein acetylation and metabolism are not intimately linked in cell biology. And the fact that, you know, these sirtuins are related to aging really layers this interdigitation of metabolism and protein acetylation with aging. So they're really closely aligned.
All right, so if there wasn't an agreement from the other folks I was talking to about whether you could actually take calorie restriction from these other model organisms to...
Yeah, I didn't get that far in my answer.
Right.
Right? I was getting there.
Right.
But I was first I gave you the broad view about basic research, right? Mm-hmm. Now, as far as calorie restriction, I think I would say it's right now in the field of aging, I think it's a circus. It's a zoo. People do all different things to different organisms that they call calorie restriction. And it's very likely, to my mind, that you know when you lower the calories to one level or to a different level, or instead of lowering the calories, you lower methionine or another amino acid, or you do something else, that you're going to engage different pathways in cells in response to that perturbation. And you know, trying to reconcile all these different experiments that are called calorie restriction, I think is impossible when you know the methodology is so different. So I think right now, I'd like to have a sort of an anchor around rodent calorie restriction. That's what's been defined as calorie restriction, okay? And that's what you want to pose the question, does that have any relevance to humans? Okay. And the answer is, well, it depends what you want to measure. If you want to measure lifespan, of course we don't know. That's a study. You'd have to have humans on calorie restriction for decades before you would have an answer to that question. And I don't think we're going to know. We're not going to know for 20, 30, 40 years. We may never know.
Never know whether, in fact, some other process going awry was creating pathology of some kind at the same time.
You'd worry. I would worry about infectious diseases being a complication that doesn't appear in a protected laboratory house, but would appear in humans just living their lives. So I'm dubious about that. But you can say, okay, so let's put aside lifespan. What about physiological changes? And there's really hard data. So there's what comes to mind is the Pennington study, which you must know about, where they actually have been able to get a cohort of people to stay on this diet for 6 months or so. And then they can measure all the physiological changes, not all, but the hallmark changes that happen in rodents. Reduction in blood glucose, reduction in insulin levels, reduction in inflammatory markers, and so on and so forth. And it looks good. It looks like the same thing happens in people by those measures as happens in rodents. And the other thing that, of course, from my own personal interest was interesting is in the muscle, where they could take punch biopsies from these people and look at them, they saw the same changes in SIRT1 and in mitochondrial biogenesis in these humans that you see in the rodents. So I would say at a physiological level and perhaps down to a molecular level, at least in the muscle, there is a congruence between what happens in humans and what happens in rodents. Now, I think for humans, the fascinating question is the following: what is exercise? How does exercise fit in to this? Because there are a hell of a lot more humans who exercise to keep in shape than who calorie restrict. And in rodents, I'm not very happy with the data on comparing the effects of exercise with the effects of calorie restriction. There is data, and the data seems to say that it depends what you measure, but for lifespan at least, exercise is not as good as calorie restriction. It certainly works in terms of creating leanness, like calorie restriction. And I think in humans, it's a really big question is, you know, how much can you achieve with exercise alone? Okay. We'll have to see. But my gut feeling on this is that exercise is extremely important, and you're going to be able to have a very major impact on health and physiology by exercise, especially if you combine it with a reasonable diet, not a calorie restriction diet, but a reasonable diet, so that you maintain relatively low adiposity and a body weight that's appropriate for your size and stature.
Well, so on that point, here's a Cell Metabolism preview article that came out in November last year. Life is short, if sweet. And the key line here is insulin is essential for glucose homeostasis, but reducing its activity delays the aging process in model organisms. So that sounds like don't eat too much dessert, right?
It does.
And then there's a New England Journal of Medicine perspective here from December 2009, an article by Kelly Brown, Allen, Thomas Frieden saying, making the public policy case for taxes on sugared beverages. So now, there's obviously there was a government warning on smoking, and
yes,
there's taxes on.
Yes. So
let's
talk about
this?
The science first. So I think the relevant issue there is now I think we've moved away from calories as the relevant parameter for discussion. What we're really talking about now is the glycemic index, right? And, you know, that's a huge field in itself where there's been a lot of studies done that I think tend toward the conclusion that you can counteract a bad effect of calories to some degree by having those calories in the form of carbohydrates with high glycemic index. So they get converted into glucose relatively slowly. So it's a more gradual release of glucose to the blood than a huge glucose surge.
So they'd be called complex carbohydrates.
Yeah. Now, I don't think it's an open... I'm not really, you know, an expert in that area. But my impression is that the data tends towards that conclusion, but there's still argument and controversy within the field how sound that data is. Okay? But if it's true, okay, then it would say that... refined glucose, sugar, sucrose, is certainly not a good thing. And, I think there's been some progress made in that, when I was a kid, there was almost no option for, like, Diet Coke, right? There was just Coke or something else.
Right.
But diet beverages, I think, have taken a significant fraction of the market, and I imagine, I don't know this, but I imagine in people who are really health conscious, it's a very large percentage of the market. So I think that the information is there, the infrastructure is there, and the question is one of education and how you educate people about this. So, I don't think a lot about public policy, I'm just too busy with research, but I would think I would want to look through in some detail the research on glycemic index and health. And once I was convinced that the case is open and shut, and it may well be getting there, then I think the government would be well advised to play a role, which would, of course, rub up against corporate America.
Let's do a little shift here to part of your talk. I also spoke earlier to Angie Bartke, and I spoke in between to Michael Bunkowski, who was originally a graduate student with Angie, and now is in your lab
as a
postdoc. There's a nice, there's a story here. Would you sort of add a little to
yeah,
this?
Yeah, it gets to the dwarf mice
right.
That Andy has studied for many years. And what these mice, and there are various strains of dwarf mice, but what they have in common is they have a defect in a transcription factor in the pituitary called PIT1, which is either due to a mutation in PIT1 or in an upstream factor that activates PIT1 called PROP1. And these mice have a reduction in most of the hormones that are produced from the pituitary, growth hormone.
Right.
I would say, just to simplify, I would focus on two classes of hormones here. Growth hormone, which of course drives growth, and gonadal hormones, which drive reproduction. So those are down in these dwarf mice, and they live a long time. Okay, so Andy has studied those for many years. And, you know, there's issues about, you know, is it the growth hormone that's the key? Is it IGF-1, which is downstream of growth hormone, that's the key? Is it growth hormone in combination with some of the other pituitary hormones that are affected that make these mice live so long? And, you know, Andy gave a very nice keynote in which, you know, He said we're really not 100% sure, but clearly growth hormone is a key part of it, because if you knock out the growth hormone receptor, so that you have a normal pituitary, but you don't have a receptor for the growth hormone, those mice also live long. So Michael worked with Andy to study these dwarf mice, and when he came to my lab, our interest is, of course, in sirtuins. So we came to sort of a meeting of the minds and decided that it would be of interest to study the function, if any, of sirtuins in the pituitary, the tissue that produces these hormones, where the dwarf mutations exert their effect. So we in the lab have now knocked out SIRT1. Again, we get back to the top dog sirtuin, in at least 10, maybe 15 different tissues. And there's technology to do that, that's one of the major approaches that we do in our lab to study the function of SIRT1, is to knock it out here, knock it out there, but not in the whole animal, because if you knock it out in the whole animal, the effect is so severe, the animal dies, and you don't learn much. So we knocked it out in the pituitary, okay, and the mouse, for all intents and purposes, looks like a dwarf mouse.
Which implies what?
Well, it implies a lot, I think. I think this is a project that we're very much in the middle of. So this work is not finished yet. There's more to be done. My feeling is what it implies is a bunch of things. First of all, it would put SIRT1 very high up in the hierarchy, affecting endocrinology in response to diet, maybe at the top, but certainly there's nothing I know of that would be higher up than that if knocking it out is affecting all these hormonal. I mean, it's only knocked out in one, this is just SIRT1 in the pituitary, period. That one thing affects all these hormonal axes. That to me is remarkable. So if ever you wanted an example of SIRT1 being the conductor of an orchestra, to me that's it. Secondly, if you care, in biology, when we do research, a lot of it is thinking about things as pluses and minuses. So it's a little bit like computers. But you have pathways where this is a plus that goes to here, but then there's a minus that goes to, which means this is activating, this is inhibitory. And that is a very important way of thinking about things, okay? So, that said, what we were talking about earlier is SIRT1 in the soma during calorie restriction. And what we said is that SIRT1 protects muscle brain because it goes up under low food. Okay?
Right.
Now, what's happening in this case? Well, we've taken SIRT1 away, and we're getting the effect of low food or dwarfism on these mouse. These hormones are going down. So that says the wiring of SIRT1 in this central hormonal axis is 180 degrees opposed to what it is in the soma. So in calorie restriction, in the soma, SIRT1 goes up, protects the soma. Mm-hmm. In the pituitary, it goes down, and by going down, turns off growth and reproduction. Okay? Now.
But what's it doing on the gonadal axis at the same time?
Down. So the presence of SIRT1 is keeping the gonadal axis and the somatotropic axis turned on. Because, if you take it away, if you delete it, those axes go down. Okay? And in calorie restriction, in wild type, a normal mouse, those axes go down. Okay? And that prompted us to look at SIRT1 itself in a normal mouse in the pituitary. And to our surprise, it goes down, not up. Okay? So, I think the implications could be profound, but it's too early for me to be sure about this. But what I would say at this point is, so far, all we've been thinking, in fact, most everybody who studies aging thinks about is the aging of the soma. And you think about protecting the soma, because that's mm-hmm. what makes you live longer, right? And so you think of calorie restriction, you think of, food abundance versus food scarcity. And in food scarcity, you're turning, on these protective mechanisms, okay? But getting back to the Kirkwood theory of aging, this comes full circle with my idea of trade-offs, our discussion of trade-off. The Kirkwood theory would say that what you have resources that have to be directed one way or the other way. So you need a switch that says the resources under some conditions are going to go to the soma. Okay, food is scarce, but if food is abundant, you don't care about the soma. You put the resources in reproduction, you have your progeny, and you've won.
Right.
Okay? So, SIRT1 now, what's it doing? What did we just say? Well, when you take food away, it's going up in the soma, and it's going down in the pituitary, so you protect the soma and you turn off mating. And now, you give food, and this is over a period, so if food is abundant, then it goes down in the soma, it goes up in the pituitary, and it drives growth and reproduction. So it's sitting on both sides of the fence. It's not only important
right.
in the minus food condition, it's important in both food scarcity and food abundance. So to me, what it looks like is, next time I talk with you, I may come and say, what I said last time, forget about it. Because that's what happens when you're in the middle of a project, right?
Science.
But you want to know, and you promise you're not going to scoop me and compromise our eventual publication on this topic. I trust you. So here's what I would say. SIRT1 is the molecular switch. It's the molecular embodiment of the Kirkwood theory of aging.
Yeah.
That's what I think. But that's still not etched in stone by any means.
So when you are...
And if that's true, that's very important, because that really gives you a very large now context in which to think about the problem.
Right.
And it opens up for... And if you're interested in sirtuins, which we are, heretofore, we've only been studying them in the context of food limitation. Now we have a whole new thing to look at. What are they doing when food is abundant to promote growth and reproduction? What can we learn from that about SIRT2 biology that might give us yet other insights into aging?
So when you are bioenergetically and physiologically flush, then you can have offspring and increase your reproductive fitness.
Yes.
When you are challenged physiologically and bioenergetically, you look after yourself until you can get to a flush state.
Because you want to delay aging, but delaying means hanging on. Even if it's by your fingernails, you got to hang on and stay young enough to reproduce later. So I think it's, and in my lecture here, I call it a big idea. And I think it is a big idea because it embodies, you know, any of these other topics you've asked me about, be it diet, be it this or that. I mean, it's subsumed by this sort of a binary switch that is playing out in us, maybe. And it's much more intricate than you would have thought, I think. Because now you have the same molecule, SIRT1, going oppositely in two different tissue types.
Right.
And how that can happen, how that's possible, is itself bewildering at this point.
Right. But, so when you have a big idea, what's the prognosis? How do you then start testing it? How long is it going to take? What are you looking at in terms of?
Well, you know, I think this project, the way we like to do things is we like to figure out what's going on at the level of the whole animal. Okay, and I think we've done that here. Okay, so now we would like to say, well, why does taking away SIRT1 have this effect in the pituitary? And the clue is this big clue. It looks like the dwarf. So what's the defect in the dwarf? It's these transcription factors I told you about. So are those connected molecularly? So that's what we need to do. And, you know, I'm going to sit on Bonkowski for a few months until those experiments get done. And at that point, at least for this problem of, you know, what is SIRT1 doing in the pituitary, that would be a nice package, publication, but it's a piece of work, complete piece of work. As far as the larger context, you know, whether the big idea is right or wrong, that will play out in many complicated ways involving many people, lots of fights, arguments, and so on, but it will play out. But you can't. I don't worry about that. I worry about what we're doing at the bench and how do we get this completed rigorously and to a level of satisfaction that we can sit back and say, we have some understanding of what's going on here.
Sounds like you're having fun.
Well, you know, that's, you never know where research is going to take you. And, you know, if we end up really studying, you know, reproduction and you know, how this is happening, that's a pretty big change from a year ago, okay? And it gets you to fascinating questions of what about this, you know, yeah, talk about aging, and everybody's worried about aging in the soma, right? Because that's us, right? Evolution has really solved the problem of aging. The species doesn't age. Why doesn't the species age? The germline doesn't age. Mm-hmm. What does that mean? The germline gets reset. Clock is reset every generation. So any aging that might have happened in that one generation from the previous one, right, is erased somehow. Right? How does that happen? I don't know. But if you're studying reproduction, you know, that those are questions that now appear on your radar screen. So it is interesting, and you don't know where you're going to go. And you have to, the key to, I think, staying young in research is to be open.
Mm-hmm. The interesting thing about this meeting, and I know you've got to go back and watch one of your students, is that we ranged across a lot of disciplines there. And you're also talking about a research program that involves going across a number of disciplines there. And one of the things about this meeting is the number of disparate disciplines that are coming together mm-hmm. to deal with these sorts of issues, mm-hmm. which I think is an interesting sign.
Yeah. Yeah, I think aging, though, by its very nature, ought to be like that. There ought to be a lot of different approaches, areas represented at a meeting like this. So it's good that it is, and it's entirely appropriate.
Yeah. Okay, well, so let's do this again, and as you move down the experimental procedures, and see where we get to next time.
Very good.
Good to see you, Len.
Take care.